everyone. Welcome to the Curiosity Cast, a place where we explore a variety of topics, meet interesting people, and follow our curiosity wherever it takes us. I'm your host, Allie Merrill, and thanks for tuning in. My first guest is someone I'm really excited to share with you. Her name is Emily Koppel. She is a nurse who has practiced nursing internationally with MSF, World Vision, Samaritan's Purse, and Mercy Ships. And she's just a fascinating human being who has a big heart for others, and I am proud to call her a friend and also call her my cousin. Here she is. Thank you so much for chatting with me today, Emily. First off, Emily, if you can just share your name and a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, and a little bit of your background, that would be great.
Sure. Well, my name is Emily Koppel, and like Allie said, I'm Allie's cousin. I grew up in Southeast Asia. We ended up moving there, well, my folks did, after the Vietnam War in the late 70s. And they were working with a relief and development organization that asked them to relocate to Southeast Asia. So they went and ended up having kids. So myself and my brother and sister, who are both 2 and 4 years older than me, we all grew up in first in Jakarta, Indonesia, and then Hanoi, Vietnam.
How long were you in Vietnam?
I was in Vietnam for 12 years. So we moved to Hanoi when I was 5 years old. And we were one of the first American families to live in Hanoi after the Vietnam War. So it was a pretty unique experience just because Hanoi still, Vietnam in general was still quite a closed country since the war. Like the remnants of the war were still quite visible. And so when we moved there, the economy hadn't opened up yet, and the government was still very much in control. And so all of the buildings were painted the same color. There weren't very many vehicle. I mean, there were bicycle, mostly people commuted by bicycle and ciclo. But, you know, just in the last 20 years or so, the country has changed so much. So I'm grateful that I got a chance to be there, just being so little and seeing the country change and evolve over time has been really interesting.
So you grew up in Asia. That's where you spent most of your time. Did it feel like home to you throughout those years, or did you feel like an outsider, or what was that as a child? How did you process those feelings?
Yeah, it's really amazing. I mean, now that I am an adult, I can look back and reflect how it's really true how kids can normalize and adapt to so much. So even now I know that it was quite a unique childhood, but at the time it felt totally normal. I mean, I have really good memories of being in Indonesia. And at that point I was really little, but I have some really vivid memories of, you know, climbing the fruit trees in our front yard and walking along the little alley in front of our house with my Indonesian nanny, who kind of felt like a second mother. I called her my brown mother and my real mother, my white mother. So if that gives you any indication on how close we were. So Jakarta was an excellent, just a really lovely childhood. I have a lot of good memories from Jakarta. And then getting to Hanoi, that was more of my, you know, 5 years old to onwards, my developmental years where I was starting to attend school. We went to an international school in Hanoi, and it was called the United Nations International School. So most of the kids that were there were children who were there because their fathers or mothers were diplomats or businessmen. And so it provided a really interesting mix of cultures and perspectives, which looking back now, I think how awesome to be surrounded by people and just passively learning in that experience, like just by, you know, hearing people talk different language, speak different languages. And also I have vivid memories of like trading my ham sandwich for my Japanese friend's sushi rolls. And we both thought the other lunches were way better, you know? So I, yeah, looking back, I think what a rich passive learning experience for me to have.
So the sandwich trading or the lunch trading as a kid, that happens everywhere in the world, not just America.
I know, but the fact that, you know, these kids brought these beautiful lunches to school and I had a ham sandwich, which they wanted. It was
it was the one thing they couldn't get.
Yeah. No, I was thinking about the other, you know, you had asked, did I feel like an outsider? And one of the really beautiful things about an international school is that everyone is kind, because everyone's from somewhere different and different from each other, there's no, there's not a whole lot of comparison. So I remember coming back to the States and you would hear about cliques in school. And I think that's because for the most part, a lot of people came from similar backgrounds. And so there was this kind of idea that you had to diversify yourself by expressing yourself as a jock or a, you know, I don't know what the different groups were, but in international school, because everyone's already so different, there was that kind of had an equalizing factor to it. So I never really felt like an outsider. Okay. We would have these, they were called international weeks, where we would celebrate, you know, everyone's international differences and their backgrounds. And so that would mean that we would have a food bazaar where everyone would bring food from their native country. And we always brought hamburgers. And there was a parade where during International Week where we were all encouraged to wear, you know, our national dress, and the Japanese and Koreans would show up in their beautiful kimonos and hanboks, which were all intricately, beautifully sewn with these bright colors. And my mom put me in a cowboy hat. So in that regard, I felt, I felt different.
Well, and did you ever identify with the American culture? Because you really spent your life in Vietnam and Indonesia. And so did it ever feel like you were more Vietnamese than you were American, and that having that feel strange? Like, why am I wearing a cowboy hat? I don't wear this normally. Yeah. Or.
Yeah, it is interesting because in that setting, because everyone's from different countries, you're kind of known for your nationality. Even though I hadn't spent any significant amounts of time in the States, I had parents who were American. I had an American passport. And so I was known as being the American, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense because I felt American by title only. I didn't really feel American inside. I kind of felt like a mixture of the influence that my parents had and hearing about their American background. So a mixture of that influence mixed in with international school, mixed in with influences from being in Vietnam. I kind of felt like a combination of all of those things. So I didn't realize how valuable it was until I grew a little older, and I realized it's actually great that I can feel comfortable going in and meeting a group of people that may be very different from me. And I, you know, I consider it an exciting challenge to learn how to get along with people or communicate or I don't really shy away from that. And for that, I'm grateful. It's given me the opportunity to do what I do and be comfortable with it.
So tell me a little bit about what was your childhood dream growing up?
So my childhood dream, I think I was around 11 or 12 when I started thinking about becoming a nurse. So, my dad, his relief organization had different health and nutrition projects that they were involved with. And so I remember being quite young and getting to witness the impact that those projects would have on these small communities in northern Vietnam. And I remember thinking, it's amazing that you can have this health and nutrition program and these kids who used to be malnourished after a few months of receiving assistance, their outcomes just looked great. So that's where my initial curiosity came from, just seeing that impact. But I think it was really solidified when I asked a German midwife who was living in Hanoi at the time, her name was Bettina, if I could shadow her, just because I was so interested in what she was doing. She would visit these Vietnamese women at home. Her Vietnamese wasn't that great, but she had enough to be able to communicate. And I think watching that interaction, it just seemed like such a special space for her to go into the homes of these women and get up close and personal with them and offer care, develop trust, offer advice that might help them in their pregnancy. There was something so beautiful about that reaction or interaction that it was kind of an inspiring moment where I was thinking, okay, in the future, I think I want to do something like this. This really appeals to me. And so I started thinking about nursing, and then in high school, I was really interested in the creative arts and also biological sciences. So the more I thought about it, the more I realized, studying the human body, anatomy and physiology and biology, you really realize there's such a beautiful design in it. And that made me more curious to find out more. Like I feel like medicine can be an intersection of biological sciences and the creative arts, if that makes sense.
Well, and it sounds like since you see it that way, it makes sense that you're a nurse. I never had that passion for the human body, even though I can appreciate its complexities. There's never been that fascination, but I feel like that makes sense that you became a nurse if that's the way that you viewed it as a way to learn and as an art form too.
Yeah. It felt like studying human biology just gave me a look into, just even down to the cellular level, how cells can regenerate themselves. There's so much mystery in it. And I wanted to know more about that. But I also wanted to end up in a profession where I was interacting with people closely, because I love that aspect about nursing. You never know who you're going to meet on a daily basis. And that can be a good or bad thing. but you don't know what conversations you're going to have. You develop, a kind of a trust and a bond between a nurse and a patient develops really quickly. And I just think, what an honor to get to be in a space where people are willing to trust you when they're vulnerable, when maybe you can offer assistance to them. Everything about it appealed to me. So I thought, why not pursue this?
I was curious if you, when you were younger, around 11 or 12, did you have any journal entries, or like, do you remember there being any sort of specific like writing down of I'm going to be a nurse?
It's probably in a journal somewhere, but I don't. I think those journals are probably still back in Hanoi with my folks. But it was funny, the last time I was in Hanoi, my mom was digging around her in the storage, and she found a journal from when I was 8 years old. And it was surprising to me how much of a woke 8-year-old I was, because the assignment was, what do you hope for the future, or something. That's what the teacher had told us to journal about. And I was saying things like, I hope there's a female president. I hope that the world realizes that they can't destroy the environment, that we all become greener. I mean, and this was back in 1990. I don't know. I was saying all these things where I thought, that's pretty advanced for an 8-year-old.
It is.
Maybe it was just a matter of me repeating what I had heard at home, but I just thought that was funny. A lot of the issues that I'm, thinking about and currently interested in now and feel passionate about, I was passionate about back then. So at least I'm consistent. but my Aunt Allie remembers, I remember when I ended up in Sierra Leone, she was like, you're finally doing what you've been talking about doing, ever since you were little. She said she remembers me being 11 or 12 and telling her, I'm going to be a midwife in Africa or something like that. And so I think for a long time I had this idea of where I was going and where I would end up. And in a lot of ways, I mean, not in, so many direct not everything has happened the way that I thought it would, which is great because life is uncertain. But I've really been able to kind of check off a lot of goals on my life list. And that's been fun to kind of do the last few years.
And you mentioned Sierra Leone. Can you tell me some of the other places that you have practiced nursing around the world?
I had the opportunity to travel to Sierra Leone on my senior trip when I was at Northwest. And so that was with three other nursing students. And that gave me really just valuable experience and exposure to working in a low resource setting, especially a setting that had been so recently impacted by civil war. I had always kind of been interested in working in not only low resource settings, but environments where where hardship truly exists. I think after hearing my folks talk about their work with refugees, I feel like I've always had a draw to understand the stories of these people who just seem incredibly resilient. I don't think I could go through what a lot of asylum seekers and refugees go through on a daily basis and live through it. So I've always been really interested in just not only their plight, but the things they do to get through it, if that makes sense.
So we were able to work alongside both organizations called World Vision and Mercy Ships, which are two different, I mean, they were operate in different capacities, but World Vision had a project there where they were training community healthcare workers. And so we were given the task to come up with a week-long training to give to these community healthcare workers to ensure that they would be able to go return to their villages and have all the necessary skills to just do simple triage and also basic first aid. And so that was really cool because we got to meet a lot of these people who were, you know, passionate about giving back to their community. And also they had some really interesting things to share. I remember in this training session, it was the first time where I realized interactive discussion is really important. It can't just be us showing up and saying, this is how you do things. It's really important to go in with cultural humility and cultural sensitivity and listen to those and really try to understand the context and the history of the people that you're working with. So Sierra Leone gave me a good kind of tangible starting point in that regard.
So can you tell me about your most recent assignments with MSF, also known as Doctors Without Borders? Did you want to work with MSF specifically since you were little, or did that sort of just come about later on?
I have been kind of dreaming about working with them for several years. I think it's when I started to become more privy to understanding the differences between the organizations, because there's a lot. I mean, there are a lot of medical organizations out there. I feel like any small group can get together and say, okay, now we're a medical organization. So it was really important to me to find one who operated with really high standards, just in terms of their ethics and their values, how they deliver care. So MSF, I think I started becoming interested in them after hearing about how they were able to access these places that no other organizations could get to. And it made me curious, why this organization? What makes them special? And I started to realize they were granted access by whether it be governments or, you know, armed groups or whatever the context was, because they take such a strong stance on being neutral and independent. So they will offer care regardless of what side you're on, regardless of your race, creed, religion. And that really appealed to me because I feel like that's, as a healthcare provider, that's I hold true to that ethical value as well. That's important to me, to offer care to whoever is in front of me. And so the fact that they have that as one of their priority values really appealed to me. And also their independence. So they don't rely on government sponsorship. So that allows them to have a lot more freedom to move because most of it is private donorship. So they can essentially do what they want and do it quickly and well.
So when was your first assignment with MSF?
My first assignment was last year. It was supposed to be in a refugee camp in Western Ethiopia. So I got all set up and I think they had told me 2 months before I was set to show up and start work. And so I was preparing, I was reading about the context of this camp. And, you know, I had this one idea in my head about what this assignment was going to be like. And then as soon as I showed up to Ethiopia, the medical coordinator said, hey, in the last week, 10,000 residents of this refugee camp have left. So we actually don't need you there anymore. Will you be flexible and travel to the Somali region instead? Which that was kind of a shocking question because I had, you know, prepped for 2 months to go to this one specific place. But MSF has this tout line of being flexible and they take that really seriously. So at the time I was thinking, okay, I'm going to be flexible. I'm going to show them what I'm made of. I'm going to accept this assignment, even though, to be honest, I was quite nervous just because the Somali region is considered a higher security context than where I was, you know, where I had accepted to go previously. But I wanted to try it out. It was a really fascinating project, what they were doing. It was, a mobile clinic health project, and it was in this town kind of out in the middle of nowhere. It took 3 hours to, take a plane from the capital out into the desert. And, the mobile clinic health project, there were 17 mobile sites that our teams would travel to on a weekly basis. And these mobile sites were set up for the nomadic bush people who move around the desert with their livestock and they don't have access to healthcare, just given the geographical proximity, like they're out so far. And so our goal was to provide at least essential services for these populations. And so it was a really good opportunity. I had never encountered, I mean, it was such a unique experience to get to interact with some of these communities that still live very, their primary source of nutrition is camel milk. They don't have access to clean water a lot of times. And so that, I don't know, just realizing that people can adapt to such harsh conditions living in the desert was a really interesting experience. So I was there for 4 months and unfortunately I had to cut my assignment early just because I had, in the duration of being there for 4 months, I was a part of 3 different security incidences. So when I arrived to the Somali region, there were quite a few kind of socio-political changes that were happening in the region. And because of this, the border between us and Somalia was open, so people could freely come and go. And unfortunately, Al-Shabaab had a presence in that area. And they're a militia group who target humanitarian aid workers. So thankfully, I wasn't kidnapped, but the risk was certainly there. And after they sent a security expert in from Amsterdam, he assessed the situation and determined that it wasn't safe to continue doing what we were doing in the areas where we were going. So I got in touch with MSF and I said, hey, you know, I'm not sure that I feel totally comfortable going out on my own every week with 8 Somali staff and kind of being the only expat. I feel like I'm in way over my head. Because I was also security responsible, which means I had to radio back and give coordinates every half hour to wherever we were going. I mean, I just felt like I was way in over my head. So at that time I said, do you have a safer context where I can go? Because I think I'll be more useful working in a setting where I can just focus on the healthcare aspect rather than security. And they did.
Throughout your time there, were there, it sounds like it was probably a mixture of some of these more intense security incidents, but also the positive side of nursing out in such remote regions. Do you feel like there was anything specific that you took away from your 4 months there that stands out to you?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, despite what I just said about having to leave due to the security context, I remember going into this place and having a lot of kind of preconceived notions about the people there and, you know, the fact that it's a very conservative Muslim culture. I had all of these biases. And so I think part of the process that I really appreciated is that by getting to know my team members really well, a lot of my personal ignorance was challenged. And I love that. Like, I think that's really important for people to have their personal ignorance challenged and realize that, I don't know, it helps you realize that you can't always rely on your personal conception of things. And I wish that could happen more where we're challenged in our framework of thinking, if that makes sense. So sorry, I'm getting a little bit out there, but that was one of the things that I really appreciated, because by bonding with my Somali team members and, you know, laughing about certain things, even though sometimes there was mistranslation or cultural differences, like it really proved to me that wherever I go in the world, there will always be, I can always find some sense of connection with whoever I'm interacting with, despite the vast cultural differences, if that makes sense. So that I'm not really speaking necessarily to, like, seeing healthcare delivery is also always really cool, but I felt like in some ways we were quite limited with what we could offer. More than going there and offering medication, I wish that there was more of a drive to provide clean water, because that's one thing that they're missing that really impacts every part of their life. So it made me realize I feel like medical organizations need to take that seriously rather than going in with a box full of medications to really consider, okay, are we considering the life-sustaining impact of clean water. I think that makes all the difference in the world.
I would imagine a lot of the sicknesses and diseases and symptoms that people experience are probably based off of not having access to clean water in the first place. And if they had access to clean water, would that alleviate some of those diseases that you guys were treating?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Clean water, it really showed me how much, you just think about we'd see a lot of respiratory infections and diarrheal diseases, UTIs. I mean, a lot of things. Yeah, clean water makes all the difference in the world. So, and I'm very much of the belief that if you can prevent rather than treat, I'd way rather do that. So I wish that more of the world took that approach. Thankfully, later in Bangladesh, I got to work alongside the water sanitation team, who are all of these water engineers who are responsible for putting in networks in the refugee camp, like water networks. And you just see what an impact that has, way more than delivery of healthcare.
Okay, so you left Ethiopia. You were in the Somali region of Ethiopia.
Yes.
And where did they assign you next?
So then they assigned me to Bangladesh. There is a refugee camp in Bangladesh that is made up of the Rohingya people. Which, coming back to the States, I have asked a lot of people, do you know about the Rohingya? Because in my mind, it's like a present day, just the scale of the genocide can be comparable to the Nazis murdering the Jews. Like, it is a modern day, the scale of it can be comparable to that. And that's why it's so surprising to me that a lot of people hadn't even heard about who the Rohingya are or what's going on. So just to give a little bit of context in case you're unsure, the Rohingya are an ethnic minority of people who are mostly Muslims who have been living in the country of Myanmar for several hundred years. And for the last several decades, they've been discriminated against. And this really came to a head in 2017 when I think four Rohingya men were somehow involved with some kind of crime. Like they did something to a building. I don't know exactly what happened, but it caused such a reaction from the government of Myanmar that they started to essentially ravage villages. They were burning down people's homes. They were raping women. They were killing men. They were killing kids. I mean, it was truly horrific, the violence that these people lived through. And so on account of the violence, these people fled into neighboring Bangladesh, so right across the border, and set up a refugee camp. So now there's a million of these displaced refugees living in the country of Bangladesh within a restricted zone. It was my first time working with people who have endured so much and are still so restricted in their ability. I mean, they barely have any personal freedom or rights. They're not allowed to leave this restricted area where their camp is. They're not allowed to work. They rely on, the World Food Program to bring them sustenance every day, every week. They rely on humanitarian aid agencies to provide healthcare, and they get their gas tanks filled up to be able to cook with or make fires to cook with. So they really, seeing the level of kind of reliance that this whole community of people have on the humanitarian aid sector, and realizing that the world has essentially not forgotten them, but why is this happening in this day and age? Why do we turn a blind eye to a million people? And I think back in 2017, when this crisis was really at a head, it garnered a lot of international attention, but it made me realize that with time, people start to lose interest, and just because that happens doesn't change the circumstances of these people. So it was a really unique opportunity to get to live and work amongst people who have been through so much and are still going through so much. And I feel like it's given me this perspective that I never, ever want to take for granted my own personal, sense of freedom or personal sense of the ability to move where I want to, or make choices, or study what I want to, or work where I want to. Those are really beautiful gifts. And I've come away with a really sharp focus of never wanting to take those things for granted.
So during that time, that's a long time to be in one place and enough time to get to know people too.
Yeah.
What was your sense of the future for that camp and the future for the refugees there? Are they wanting to return to their home, or are they wanting to stay in Bangladesh and be allowed to work? What's sort of the feeling there of those people?
I felt like with the people that I asked, it was kind of a mixture. It seemed like a lot, I remember asking this because we'd always get these groups of kids that would gather outside of the clinic. So as we were getting in the MSF van to leave every day, there would be a group of kids come up and want to, that were yelling stuff at us. And we were the novel just because we were a bunch of expats. They always wanted to interact with us. And I remember asking one of them, he wanted to practice his English. So I said, "Where are you from?" And he said, "Myanmar." And so I think a lot of the Rohingya still keep that sense of identity and nationality to be, they hold that to be true still, despite what they've gone through. And I think for a lot of them, they would like to return home. but they don't want to return home where there is such a high risk for violence as well. So last year, on the 2-year anniversary of the Rohingya entering Bangladesh, the Bangladeshi government attempted to create a repatriation act where they got all of these empty buses inside the refugee camp, and essentially they were encouraging the refugees to return back over the border to Myanmar. And I think out of a million people, there were like 7 of them who got on these buses. Everyone else didn't want to return because of the horrific violence that they had escaped from. And so I think for some of them, they have a desire to return to Myanmar, but only if it's, you know, guaranteed safety and peace. And they're not guaranteed that if they return. So a few others that I talked to said, you know, we're glad that we're safe here in Bangladesh, but it also feels like we're living in prison because we can't go out of this restricted area. We're not allowed to work. So what kind of life is that, okay, you know, when you think about it? So yeah, I heard a mixed bag from people. The general feeling in the camp is, I think it's difficult for people to maintain hope though, because there's so much uncertainty with their future. They don't know what is to come.
You were sharing with me the story of when the Bangladesh government said, we need 17 heads of people to come help us with this building project. Do you mind telling that story?
No, not at all. I mean, it's a really good example of how just through cultural differences, things can be miscommunicated or mistranslated. So the Rohingya are mostly a verbal community. Not all of them are literate. And so a lot of them rely on oral passages of communication in order to receive information. And they're a big oral culture, let's say that. And so at the beginning of working in Bangladesh, I realized it's very important. I mean, just when you think about messaging, how health promotion messaging is given to these people, we have to be very sensitive to how that information is received. And one example that I had shared with you was that the Bangladeshi government, I forget what initiative they were working on, but they essentially put out this announcement saying, we need 17 more heads of Rohingya people to assist us with this project. And that message was taken so literally that the rumor within the camp was that, oh, the Bangladesh government needs 17 heads of children. I mean, it went to this really extreme place, which given kind of the traumatic background of these people, you understand why. I think they're terrified. And so they took that message really literally and seriously. And there, you know, people were hiding their kids in their house. They were really terrified that it was a literal message. And so that was one example of how I think it's really important, just realizing how information is disseminated in the camp. We had to be very careful. And thankfully, MSF is quite sensitive to that. So they would hire Rohingya, we call them cultural mediators, and they're Rohingya by background, but they're also usually proficient in English, and they act as mediums between us and the community. So they tell us, oh yeah, it would be better if you used this type of word in the message, or, you know, make sure that you're aware of X, Y, and Z. So I appreciate that MSF made an effort of being sensitive to those differences.
Yeah, because that's a lot of cultures combining into one. I can only imagine the amount of miscommunication, and also in the medical realm, having to explain things and through a translator, all of that. So, yeah, that's a lot to manage. And I'm sure that there were times that you guys experienced that miscommunication, or I don't know if that's the correct term, but just wires getting crossed within your individual?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm trying to think. So we had an isolation department at our clinic, and the purpose of this isolation tent was to put anyone who was suspected diphtheria, which is an infectious disease, or we had another tent for measles as well. And so there was one night, I wasn't in the clinic because we're not allowed to stay in the camp at night. The expats aren't. And so our clinic staff had told this man who brought in his child with the diphtheria that he couldn't have guests in the isolation tent. And the man who had brought his friends in to just stay with him didn't understand why. And so it was an interesting conversation. He got very offended when the clinic staff told him, hey, you have to ask your friends to leave, because he thought he was being discriminated against. And I think that was another kind of challenging element to all of this. We had to be very careful with how things are communicated, because it is such a sensitive population, given what they've been through. I think a lot of small, I think they view the world through the lens of being discriminated against. So anything that they hear might be tainted because of their experience. And so, you know, we had a whole session on therapeutic communication with the clinic staff just to try to reinforce, we have to be as respectful as possible, and also, you know, try to explain things in a way that makes it very easy to understand, rather than just don't do this, don't do that, because that might not be received well.
We've sort of had a more serious leaning just because of the nature of your work. But I'm curious if there are any funny nursing stories that stand out to you. I'm sure you have a lot. But do you have a favorite that you could share?
A favorite nursing story? I feel like I mean, every day that I was at Harborview was funny in some way.
And Harborview is in Seattle, Washington, correct? Yes. You're on the medical floor there.
One story that I like to tell out of the Somali region was, so we were set up, this was one of my first days in the country at the project, so I was still like getting my bearings, getting used to everything. And we were at this site, and this old man comes running up to the entrance of the site, and he's like waving his stick around. He looks like he's about 100 years old, and he looks really distressed. And so I got one of my national colleagues to translate. I was like, hey, obviously this guy is upset. Can you tell me what he's saying? And so she started to translate, but she got a little bit red as well. Like, you could tell that she was getting a little bit uncomfortable. And she said, he's saying he's having an emergency. And I said, okay, well, what's going on? Is he having trouble breathing? Like, in my head, I'm thinking, what's going on with this guy? And she said, no, he said that last week he married his fourth wife. And then she paused. And in my mind, I'm like, okay, what's going on here?
Emergency?
Yeah. And the translator continued saying, he married his fourth wife, and he said that he paid a lot of camels for her, and he's very concerned because he hasn't been able to make her his wife. And I said, what? What do you mean? And she said, in bed. He hasn't been able to make her his wife in bed. And so he needs emergency medication for that.
Oh my gosh.
Thankfully, another expat colleague that I was with stepped in and said, okay, you need to explain to this man that MSF will not prescribe Viagra. We're not that kind of emergency organization. We are, you know, we treat life-threatening
right, things. Right.
But oh, the concern so on this funny. Man's face, yeah, to him, it was a true emergency. So it's all relative.
Right. You just had to balance your view of the emergency. wow. Well, Emily, what would you say makes you most curious about the life we live? what stands out to you? And it can be deep, it can be funny, it can be random, but what is sort of like grabs you?
Well, I think just amidst what we're all going through right now, it's been really interesting to view people's reaction to uncertainty. And I don't know, you know, there is a lot of uncertainty with the COVID-19 crisis, but it makes it clear in my head that we all need to be totally okay with realizing that certainty and control and comfort are all illusions that can be gone like that. And I think that's what keeps me curious. I'm like, how can we maintain uncertainty and still realize what a beautiful gift life is? Because I think a lot of people are kind of caught up in the anxiety of all of it. And it's been interesting to watch, like, a lot of people aren't even okay with being at home, which home is supposed to be one of the most comfortable places. And so it makes me realize, I think just on a societal level, we struggle with being still and being okay with, you know, what we have. And that, I don't know, I hope that people keep saying, oh, I hope everything returns back to normal. And I really hope it doesn't. I hope that this kind of turns over a new leaf in our collective society so that we're able to, like, just with a sharper focus, realize what we have and to not take it for granted ever. And to use what we have to assist others. So that's what I want to kind of pursuing uncertainty with that perspective is what I want to stay curious about.
Thanks for joining me for this episode of the Curiosity Cast. For more content and episodes, you can visit www.thecuriositycast.com or follow us on Instagram @thecuriositycast. Stay curious.